sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. This morning, we are also joined by J.D. Gunnell, who is a professor at USU Extension. And J.D., thanks for being with us this morning. You're here because you are our tree expert, and we are starting out the 9 o'clock hour talking about pruning, oh my goodness, Saturday mornings, pruning fruit trees. And this is, Ton, a really tough one to talk about on the radio.
It can be, because it's like trying to describe how to ride a bike over the radio, where it's just something you have to watch and you have to do to get the experience you need.
Given that, people are going to start wanting to prune their fruit trees.
Mid-February is the time you start for the Wasatch Front, and early March for colder mountain valleys for apples and pears. And so the apples and pears, there are some principles, and I'm glad JD's here today to talk more about these, but there are certain principles with pruning fruit trees before you even start getting in how you want to shape the canopy. And they would include dead and diseased wood, dead wood, and sucker sprouts around the base.
Yeah. I start with what I call the easy cuts. Because even knowing how to prune, after a long winter, you're rusty. And so even for people to do it professionally, it takes a little bit to warm up, get the juices flowing. So suckers, water sprouts, so that's the suckers come at the base of the trunk. Water sprouts are the very vertical branches going up through the canopy that just don't do anything but shade. So those are what I start with. Anything crossing, hanging down, if it hits my head when I'm walking past it, it's a goner. So those are the ones I start with. But it's the most important thing with pruning is not what you're taking, it's what you have left. And most people overdo it. They'll prune really heavy, really hard, and then hope that they can take a couple years off. And what happens is the harder you prune a tree, the more regrowth happens, because there's a balance. And that tree tries to find an equilibrium. And when you get in there and start messing too much, then it throws it out of whack. Like the caller before that wasn't getting apples for a decade. It's if you're pruning too hard, you're promoting a lot of vegetative growth, and that's at the expense of fruiting wood. And so apples and pears are very similar to the way they prune. But then when you get into the stone fruits, it's exactly opposite. And so, like you say, talking about it, all that does is add to frustration. That's why Extension, we do a lot of pruning demonstrations where you can come do some hands-on. I have trees at our community garden, and I tell people, you get to practice on someone else's tree and then go home and perfect it. And that's kind of the best way I've done it. When I tried to learn pruning, I actually went to an orchard and said, would you like some free labor? I'm here, just teach me. And for days, I just sat and pruned. It was with Thor, the old research tech at Utah State.
Yeah, I did the same thing when I moved to Utah County and started working in the fruit industry. Brent Black actually brought me down to Kaysville and dropped me off with a pair of pruners. And for Thor and I spent some time both in Kaysville and Utah County pruning. And it wasn't homeowner pruning. You know, the principles are a lot of the same, but it was this technique and this technique and this technique. And it took some time to not only learn how to do it, but for that learning to stick long enough that if you waited a year that you could go in and somewhat confidently do it again.
Yeah. So I'd like to tell people that hearing about pruning is one dimensional. Reading about pruning is two-dimensional. Doing pruning is when you get the 3D effect.
Yes. And so, I mean, the principles of dead and diseased wood, sucker sprout, you know, suckers at the base, water sprouts up in the tree, but then is when it gets hard.
Yeah. And if you lined up 10 horticulturists on the same tree, that tree would come out looking 15 different ways.
No.
It would. The fruit growers have a tour every winter, and every 3 or 4 years, they have a pruning demonstration by a visiting professor. And part of what they do is they will get 3 or 4 representatives from 4, you know, different orchard families and just let them go to town on a peach or an apple tree. And in every case, they look different when you're done.
I want black and white on these things.
It's not. It's like we were talking earlier. Horticulture is as much art as it is science. And so once you understand where the fruit is on each species, you protect that wood.
Yes, and that's the principle. Even though the trees look differently, you're protecting the fruiting wood and controlling the growth of the tree to make it easier to harvest, or the goals. And you can actually get to a point, if you work on an orchard, that your guys have gone through the trees and you know down to the worker who pruned the tree just by their style. But even though they look a little different, the principles of how much wood comes out and, you know, the dead and diseased wood stay the same.
So when you do decide which branches to cut, where do you make the cuts?
So there's only two. So the good news here is most people can remember two things. And there's only two cuts you can make. And those are heading cuts and thinning cuts. A heading cut is what most people do when they shorten a branch. They're just indiscriminately shortening a branch, and that's a heading cut. But with those cuts, you need to look at the buds and the direction the buds are going, because anytime you cut above a bud, that bud's going to take dominance and grow and become the dominant terminal bud. And so if that bud's facing in towards the tree, then that next year you're going to have to cut that branch out because it's growing into the interior of the tree. So when you do a heading cut, you find a bud that's facing the direction you want the growth to go. And you're directing where the future growth will go just from that teeny bud.
Oh, wow.
So that's a heading cut.
My mom's been doing this wrong for years, by the way.
Yeah. It takes, okay. Once you learn it, so I'll watch orchardists prune, and it's like they're not thinking. They're just in automatic mode. But in their head, it's probably going 50 miles an hour. Looking at buds, directions, the overall shape of the tree. The thinning cuts, to me, are the easiest because you're removing an entire branch where it connects. And so you're cutting an entire branch that's not doing anything. It's either coming up through the canopy, it's shading too much.
It's too tall.
Yeah. So those are typically, well, not even typically, those are always the only two cuts you can make. And so as you're pruning, you're swapping back and forth with those two cuts. And to me, I start with the thinning cuts because it's easier to make a couple really big cuts than to spend hours doing little teeny shearing type cuts.
Yeah. So some other generalities, and JD's actually put together several pruning videos on YouTube on the extension and Garden Guys and Gal also YouTube channels. But the other thing to keep in mind is that fruit trees, you don't want to take out more than about 25% of the canopy, with the exception of peaches. And if you, JD's talking about, you know, you go out and prune hard, well, you've got a lot of stored energy in the roots that wants an equivalent canopy. And when you prune too hard, the roots will restore the canopy, but in a way that you absolutely don't want. And so that controlled pruning to about 20-25% of the branches is going to be another principle you can follow. Peaches only produce fruit on one-year-old wood, and so you can take up to 50% of the branches out of a peach.
Because you want to take enough wood this year to stimulate growth for next year's fruit.
Yes. Yeah, so in 2024, the pruning you're doing now is generating fruit for 2025.
Again, three-dimensional. So doing is actually how you
Yes,
it.
And so attend a pruning demonstration, watch the videos, look at the fact sheets, and we've posted one that has how to make the pruning cuts and some really good general advice, but it's just getting your hands dirty and getting in and doing it.
Okay, and again, how will people know the exact time they should prune each type of fruit tree?
Apples and pears in mid-February. We do that because they're more tolerant of pruning in the cold, but we're trying to prevent the spread of a disease called fire blight. And then the stone fruits, which are peaches and cherries and plums, and that group mid-March.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Mark, you're up next on the phone lines. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Mark is on the line in Salt Lake City. And good morning, Mark. What was your question?
Hi. I bought a pickle plant from Home Depot, and within about 2 or 3 weeks, I killed it, I believe, it by overwatering it. And so my first question is, how often should I water a pickle plant, and what is the bottom temperature that they can live in, the coldest?
Well, so typically on a house plant, you only water about every 7 to 10 days. They need to dry out in between waterings. The best indicator is actually your finger. If you dip your finger into the soil or the media mix and it comes out different color, then it's got plenty of water. If the soil is dry, you can't get your finger in there very easy, then it's time to water.
What is the bottom temperature that they can live in?
55 degrees. They're, the pickle plant's kind of a cactus mimic, a succulent, with those tall spear, you know, and so you don't want to get them below about 50 or 55 at night. And when you grow them, you're going to be using a cactus mix for, you know, transplanting them into, because they're just not one that'll tolerate a lot of water.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener says, their forsythia is huge and out of control. Help, and you're going to say, don't cut it now.
Well, you can use renewal pruning on it and save a lot of the flowers if they do prune it now. But, I mean, if it's been a problem for years, what's waiting another month or two?
Wait till it blooms with all those gorgeous blooms first.
If you don't care about the blossoms, it doesn't matter. You can cut it early spring. The reason we tell people to wait on forsythia and lilac is if you prune early, you've pruned off the flowers. But on something big and rangy and out of control, you'll go to the base of the plant, count the canes or estimate, divide that by 3 and take that many out. A third of the biggest, gnarliest, thickest canes out to the ground. And then it helps open it up. It helps
from the base, as close as you can get to the base of the bush.
Yep. And that's what Tom refers to as renewal pruning. You're renewing that shrub, taking out the oldest branches.
And after you do that, you'll reduce the size by at least 30%. But what branches are left over, you can go in and give it a light haircut and bring it down another foot or two and easily bring its size down to 5 or 6 feet.
What not to do is what you see very commonly is people take hedge trimmers and just shear it into a shape of a light bulb. So when it blooms, it looks like a light bulb. Don't do that.
It's not supposed to look like a light bulb.
No, nothing in nature.
It's a little more free spirited than that, right?
Yes.
Forsythia are one of those bushes, and I mean, this is where Ton should keep his mouth shut.
But you won't.
But they're beautiful for about 3 weeks out of the year, and it's another shrub without regular maintenance. It's quite rangy.
But it's one of the earliest bloomers.
It is.
I have one in my yard because it's my mental, it's for my mental health. When I see that thing bloom, I know there's hope.
For flowering plants throughout the summer. Oh.
So
the growing season.
About
coming.
A month ago, we talked about witch hazel and winter hazel. Maria wasn't impressed, I don't think.
We have a couple in the botanical gardens, and
they're weird.
I'm never out walking through the arboretum in January to enjoy the flowers.
Right.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. Next listener says last year they planted red potatoes and Yukon Gold. All of them are green all the way around, even though they were deep in the dirt. They cut off all the green, but it wastes about 10 to 20% of the potato, and they want to know what went wrong.
Potatoes need to be lifted from the ground and stored at around 50 or 55 degrees. And so what you'll do is pull them out and just let them sit in a room at around 70 degrees for a week to 10 days so that the skin hardens and cures. And then you will take those potatoes and get them down to the coolest room you have. And starting in late October, the garage is actually the best place for potatoes. And I just store mine in a wooden shelf that I have a door over the shelf to keep the light from penetrating. But the potatoes form green chlorophyll under the skin when they're exposed to light.
And it doesn't have to be a lot of light.
No.
Even in my cold storage, I've noticed my potatoes go green. Mm. So you do have to trap the light out.
You do. And so, but storing them at 55 degrees and keeping them, that's why I have the extra hinge door over the top. My grandpa used to leave them in his garage, and he had built into his garage shelves. He put some plywood in there and braced it and put a hinged door on his and put styrofoam around it to insulate it a bit. But it would hold 50 pounds of potatoes, and he would just stack his potatoes in there when he needed them. We'd go out to the garage and lift up the door, pull out what we needed, and we shut, and it'd keep them dark. And because that it was against the wall, it kept them warm enough. But that 50 to 55 degrees is perfect for potatoes.
Okay. Grant is on the line in West Jordan. Good morning, Grant. What can we help you with?
Hello. I have a blue spruce tree of about 20 years, upwards of 40, 45 foot tall, and it's been healthy most of its life. Last year, however, we noticed that the ends of the branches had new growth on them, nice, soft, tender needles. But the interior parts of the tree all the way up, I've never had so many dropped needles, and now the tree looks like it's barren from the trunk to the tip on the inside looking up.
Okay.
Is it a disease or a fungus, or what am I looking at?
So typically spruce don't have disease problems. They're a very hardy tree for our area. They do have trouble with water. They're very shallow rooted. The roots are usually within the top foot or 18 inches. And because of that, it fluctuates a lot. Now, what you're seeing now probably happened last year and the year before. And we've had a lot of really hot, dry summers. Spruce roots will go out 2 to 3 times wider than the canopy. And so they're very susceptible to drought stress. And when they're drought stressed, they will drop needles. And the most critical time to keep spruce watered, besides the hot summer months, is in the fall before the ground freezes. And I've noticed some neighbors' trees that are kind of going that burgundy, dry, needled color. And it's just when the ground's frozen, the water can't get to them. Even though it's raining outside right now, a lot of the ground is still frozen, so those roots can't take that water up. So make sure they go to bed wet. But to me, it sounds like a drought issue.
Oh, great. So more water, 2 times the width, at least, of the lower branches.
Yep. Which is opposite from what we usually tell people, conserve water, save water, but trees do need deep drinks. Not all the time, about once a month.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I was hoping it wasn't a disease or a fungus, and you've kind of answered and given me hope.
The only disease I can think of that could have been is needle cast, and it doesn't really fit the pattern for needle cast.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning. Next listener would like to know, will groundnut grow here or in Weber County, and where would they get some?
Ground nut.
So Apios americana.
Oh, now they're flexing on us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see who can Google faster.
Yeah, and then they also wanted to know whether these would be like a seed potato. What are these, first of all, Ton?
If
I don't know,
it's correct. They're just related to peanuts, or they are peanuts, and so.
Well, with your Georgia background, let's hear it.
Well, and you can grow peanuts in Utah. Dean Miner, one of our colleagues, has done it for years. The yields aren't as high. And as long as we're going down the same route here, just because, you know, I don't know what today is, but we're getting all the obscure stuff. And
Shady's here.
Yeah. So, you know, best I can really say, if it is a type of peanut, yes. But if you're referring to something else, I'm just this one of these things that I'm just going to have to take a pass because I have no experience with it.
Now, peanuts are a very long season. And my guess is the groundnut would, too. So you'd have to start it indoors way before the growing season.
Yeah. So peanuts, Dean starts them in early May, and he has darker weed fabric around, and just at any rate, he does get a crop, but it's about half what you would in the Southeast.
Okay, we need to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Number to call, phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, J.D. Gunnell with us this morning. Taking your calls and questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. J.D. has been with us this morning because he's our tree expert. So if you have tree questions, this is the weekend to call. Again, that number to call, 801-575-8255. Next listener, guys, says they're going to lay some sod this spring. What is the process that they should go through to prep the yard and get rid of all of the old grass that is full of weeds?
Well, I would, if there's a few different things you can do. In the spring, I would let the grass grow and come out of dormancy. And if you want to get rid of it, don't water it, but you would have to go 2 or 3 months before it was actually dead. Or I just spray it out with Roundup, or probably Roundup, because the grass killers that are available actually are not very effective against Kentucky bluegrass. And so I would just spray it out in the spring and make sure things are dead. And once, you know, everything's brown and not returning, then you can go ahead and remove it. You can get a sod cutter or a very durable tiller. You know, I'm talking industrial tiller, and just go from there.
Yeah, be patient, though, because like Ton's saying, it has to be actively growing for that glyphosate to work. It's got to be 60 degrees, and the plant has to be actively working to make it all the way through the root system.
So I have a park strip that I've been trying to kill the grass for with by just not watering it for a couple of years, and it's undergone a lot of construction now, so it looks like everything's dead, but I need to wait till when to know if there's actually still grass and weeds and stuff in there.
Probably mid to late May, because you have spring annuals and, you know, what are called winter annuals that are actually growing through late May, but then you have things germinating through May into June, and you're always going to have things germinating in there, but it's one of those things that if you did spray it out in the fall, you've probably killed all the perennial weeds, and they're just annual weeds germinating, so you could get a weed torch. They're fun as long as there's not a lot of debris.
Don't give my husband an idea of some
Bob,
other
if you're
thing
listening,
to buy
weed
and
torch.
Ton loves fire.
So would the glyphosate work then? And at the end of May, just see what's growing and
yeah,
fill out
don't let things
left.
Go to seed and just spray it out with glyphosate.
Okay, I don't know. We've been trying for a couple of years here. I'm hoping the construction crews have now helped me kill it all off.
Per square foot of soil, there are sometimes millions of weed seeds that you can't see.
That's what
and
I'm saying.
And so you're never, unless you stretch clear plastic over the park strip and then, you know, secured the sides, you're never going to kill the weed seeds in there. And so if you were to leave that all summer, then that would kill the weed seeds out and you'd have a fresh start the next spring.
Until you till it.
Yeah.
And then bringing up all new seeds.
Okay. Well, this is one of those water wise experiments. So we're not going to be planting any more grass in there. It's one of those north of your house park strips that the grass never did well anyway. And the kids trampled it on the way to and from school in the winter. So we're just going to try and do something totally different. Next listener would like to know, is it too late to prune raspberries? These are the ones that just produce one time.
Nah, get them pruned. You're good. Just trying to cut them down 2 or 3 inches off the ground. You can just take a hedge trimmer out there and do your worst with them. Do your best. Excuse me.
Okay. Dee in Midvale would like to know if she can, when she can prune the choke cherries.
I would probably push it as far as possible. I mean, even you can prune now, but when it's wet weather and you have a fresh wound on a tree, it makes it really susceptible to any disease that's floating out there, especially those that are not choke cherries, but apples and pears are very susceptible to fire blight. And the general rule is don't prune when it's wet.
Yeah. And so you can spread Cytospora, Pseudomonas, fire blight. You know, canker causing diseases are commonly spread if you trim during wet weather.
Okay. Next listener is Bobby in Malad, Idaho. Hey, thanks for joining us. What is your question this morning?
Yes, yeah, so on our farm, we have an old homestead site, and there's an old crabapple tree. And I successfully grafted on a good apple variety to it. but it had been so uncared for 50, 60 years that spring I went in and I was really aggressive, really cut out all the dead, but also cut out a lot of live. And that next spring there was sprouts on every square inch of that tree. It made it mad.
Yep. Yes.
What can I do to get that in shape?
So you can cut the water sprouts off again, but if it's more than 25-30%, I would take the water sprouts in a couple years. Don't do it all at once. It's just going to reset that cycle. And then in the summer, what'll happen is you'll start regrowing those water sprouts. You'll just break those off with your finger. Spring stimulates growth. Summer pruning slows it down. So maybe take half of the water sprouts in the spring, and then as they regrow, break them off, and then next year repeat that. You'll have to be patient.
Okay. Is it possible to get a good variety to grow grafted onto a crabapple tree? Because I still haven't had fruit on that limb.
Well, that limb's going to have to be at least 3 to 4 years old before any fruiting spurs develop. But yeah, crabapples and apples are very compatible. Apples and pears will produce fruit on old wood, so you have to wait for it to get old.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Bobby, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener says they have a 4-year-old contender peach tree that they got the borer and the trunk 2 years ago. They said they were pretty religious about spraying with dormant oil and then Garden Tech 7 following Mary and Murray's emails. I don't know what that means, but the borer made its way in spite of their efforts. It still produced a ton of large peaches last year. Is this tree doomed? Should they keep it until it dies, or should they replace it now?
It's not necessarily doomed. The borers come out, but they need to make sure that there's no turf or grass around the base of the tree. They should have a 3 or 4 foot ring of bare soil around the trunk. And if they need to really focus on spraying the lower trunk. And it's not just a once and done, it's monthly with Garden Tech, every 2 to 4 weeks if they're using permethrin. Mm-hmm. And so what I would recommend doing is starting in early June, spray probably every 2 weeks through the summer, trunk and lower limbs, especially around the base. And you can't miss a spray because the greater peach tree borer, it's a moth, and it is active all summer long laying eggs. Dormant oil will do nothing against borers. It is for aphids, spider mites, and other piercing, sucking insects that overwinter on the tree and certain diseases like powdery mildew. And so, you know, we've kind of developed this myth that a delayed dormant spray is just like the miracle spray of all miracles for fruit trees. It's just an important spray, but it's one in a series that you need to do. And don't assume that dormant oil is going after everything, because it's not.
All right. Speaking of dormant oil, we have Wendy on the line who wants to talk about dormant oil in West Jordan. Good morning, Wendy. What was your question?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Some of my questions were answered, but last year I signed up for some kind of tree service for some unknown reasons, and they showed up a week ago and sprayed dormant oil on my trees and shrubs, and I had no fruit trees. They're all ornamental and spruces, but it seemed awfully early. Does it do any good this early? I mean, it's still the middle of winter. I'm wondering if it'll last, and will it need to be reapplied?
So I'll be the bad guy here as the guest.
Ton is shaking his head.
You should not put dormant oil down anytime it's going to freeze, anything below 40 degrees or anything above 80 degrees. And so, yes, you're right. It is way too early. The best timing for dormant spray is when those buds on the trees are just waking up. They call it a delayed dormant season. And that's when insects are cold-blooded. The aphids, the spider mites, they're still fully dormant right now. And so those horticulture oils aren't going to do much for those. You want to wait until they're starting to wake up with the buds.
Because of the warmer weather, they've fortunately done no harm. But it's just one of those things that that spray shouldn't have taken place until March. And I know that these companies kind of have a schedule and they have a lot of customers, but this is one that it just shouldn't have been done yet.
Yeah, it just, I mean, they just came unannounced. I had no idea they were coming, and I had forgotten that I had signed up for something. But so should it be reapplied, and will it do any good?
Well, you may not need to. If those shrubs were having no problems with pests, then, I mean, the dormant oil hasn't hurt anything, and it's a contact killer, and so it's not like you've applied poisons everywhere, you know, and sometimes if you do a dormant spray in late winter to early spring, it is something that is beneficial for things like snowball bush and some of the honeysuckles that are aphid and powdery mildew prone. But there's a lot of shrubs out there that if they're healthy, they didn't necessarily need it. But if you're spraying preventatively, which we just don't often recommend doing, the dormant oils are going to be one of the most mild things you can do as far as not causing harm.
Okay. Well, I think I may just have to cancel that service, whatever I signed up for.
All right.
Make sure you can, because it may be written into the contract you're in for the year.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning. We need to take a break. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Jeff, you will be up next. You can also text us your questions, 57500. Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, J.D. Gunnell with you this morning, taking your calls and questions. Next listener, let's go to Jeff. I promised him he was next. Jeff is in Farmington. Good morning, Jeff. What was your question?
Yeah, good morning. I have a pasture that has a fence that between the pasture and the fence. On the other side of the fence is a road. It's about 250 feet long, the road, my fence. And in the past, I had green evergreens that have been blown down with the Farmington winds. I'm looking to put something back up to give me a visual barrier between the road and my property that would not be poisonous to cattle, horses that might be chewing on them. And I'm hoping to find something that's at least 10 feet tall. Trees would be fine. Shrubs might work. I'm just wondering what you might think would be a good option.
How wide of an area do you have? It's 250 feet long, but how wide?
Well, the pasture is like 150 feet deep, so it runs parallel to the road 250 feet, and then it comes in, like I said, about 100, 150 feet.
So the trees would be planted in the pasture?
Yeah, but right along the property line somewhere, you know, maybe within 10 or 15 feet of the property line.
Okay. Do you have plans
to
fence them?
They're dead if they don't.
Because any animal that's around the tree, like horses will debark a tree, cattle will chew on them. So you would definitely need to fence the tree that you choose, or put the tree on the other side of the fence.
Thoroughly fence it.
Does that make sense?
So that the evergreens, the cattle didn't bother.
Well, they may have been junipers or something along those lines, but any deciduous shrub you put in there, they're going to go after.
Okay.
And so what you would want to do is probably string T-posts and you'd have to have them fenced far enough away so that even the animals can't reach over and chew on them too much.
I've seen people put like cattle panel that kind of put it in a circle around the tree. But if that's the case and you protect them, the sky's the limit on species selection.
I mean, the one to stay away from are the yews.
Or choke cherries are considered toxic. I've even heard maples. The maple leaves can develop toxicity in big abundance.
But we've never seen problems with privets or lilacs.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you've got such a distance there. If you were brave, some of the soil conservancy districts, I think the cash ones still do it, And
they'll have a bare root cell, and you can get plants for very cheap.
A lot of times they'll have bare root lilacs, and if you know what you're doing, you can have like 95% survival on them and get them, like JD said, $3 or $4 each instead of 25 or 30 if you're having to buy containerized shrubs.
Okay.
Is it like a small, would a lilac suffice, or you want something bigger like a shade tree?
Well, if I could get at least 10 feet tall, it would give me the visual barrier that I'm hoping for, because the road sits up higher than the pasture.
Yeah. Then lilacs would be a great option.
Yeah, lilacs, Amur River Privet, Cheyenne Privet are fairly fast and are ones that you can find at these bare root cells sometimes.
Yep. Okay.
If you want to go that direction. But garden centers will have these in too.
Okay.
As containerized shrubs.
And is there an evergreen, a pine, or a spruce that you like that would not blow down in the Farmington winds that has a better root system maybe?
Austrian pines have a deeper root system. They have up to 5 times more roots. The spruce are the ones that you'd struggle with the shallow roots.
Austrians are more likely to be fed on by deer and livestock, so you definitely need to have that barrier there. Some of the mugo pines, the tree-form mugo pines, once they're established, are quite drought-hardy, and they may be a little harder to find the tree forms, but that would be another option if you wanted evergreen.
All right. Jeff, thanks for your call this morning. Ken in Alpine has the next question. He says he has 4 Norwegian spruce that were planted next to each other, properly spaced, and after 3 years, the 2 middle ones suddenly died, even though they all got the same water. He had a certified arborist, put in new soil, adjusted the water, and the next one died in 6 months. He did it again. The next one died in 6 months, and he's wondering what could be wrong. He says, he needs something to block the view there. That's why he keeps trying. They are against a vinyl fence, and he's wondering if that could reflect too much heat. He says it's puzzling as to why the 2 in the middle keep dying.
Typically, a fence wouldn't cause that much reflective
white
heat.
White vinyl doesn't reflect a lot of heat.
No. So 9 times out of 10, if a tree dies within the first year, it's watering almost every time. And so I would check your system if there's a plugged up line. It's fascinating to me, even at my own house. I anytime I plant a line of anything, it's the middle one that dies instead of the one on the end. And so I don't know if it's just nature's way to keep us guessing, but Norwegian spruce are typically really hardy. And so if you've lost a couple in a row, I would definitely do a soil test and see if there's anything going on with your soil, and check your irrigation system thoroughly.
All right. Next listener is Doug in Burley, Idaho. Good morning, Doug. What was your question?
Good morning. I have a question about a sweet meat squash. As I opened up one the other day, I noticed the meat in the sweet meat squash is dark orange. And then there was some light yellow marbling, almost like meat marbling, but the light yellow was very hard. And I was wondering if you might know, is that a disease or what might be the cause of that?
I would suspect there's 2 different things. One could be the heat we had last year can sometimes cause that sort of condition to happen in fruit. And there's also some viral diseases that can cause that. I know the sweet meat's an heirloom.
Tom, forgive me. Okay. We are up against the break. I am so sorry, Doug. Hang on the line. Tom will answer your question offline. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. We'll be back following the news.